It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Large-scale agriculture is not new in California. Going back hundreds of years, Mexican and Spanish land grants established massive ranchos years before the territory became part of the United States. Later, the gold rush lured the ambitious and adventurous from all over the world. One such dreamer was Heinrich Alfred Kreiser, a poor butcher who left his home in Germany and immigrated to New York City in 1846. Heinrich made his way to California in 1850. He renamed himself Henry Miller, a name that he borrowed from the non-transferable steamer ticket he had purchased from a friend in New York. Miller soon built up a thriving butcher business in San Francisco, and in 1858 went into partnership with Charles Lux, a fellow German immigrant and a former competitor. The Miller and Lux Company expanded rapidly, and vertically integrating back from meat products to cattle raising. They became the largest producer of cattle in California and one of the largest landowners in the United States, owning over 1 million acres and controlling about 22,000 square miles in California, Nevada, and Oregon. And like a scene out of Lonesome Dove, they trail cattle all the way from Texas to stock their ranch. The Miller and Lux Corporation was headquartered in Los Banos, on the west side of California's San Joaquin Valley, where Miller played a major role in the development of much of the valley during the late 19th century and early 20th century. The Miller and Lux Corporation did not long survive his death, though his family reorganized their share of holdings and are still engaged over 6 generations later. And from these beginnings, the Bowles Farming Company was formed in 1965. Today, one of Henry Miller's great-great-great-grandchildren, Canon Michael, is continuing the progressive farming tradition with a vision stating, "We farm with both organic and conventional techniques and strive to produce food and fiber in the most ethical and environmentally friendly ways possible. We also manage habitat areas that are key resources for all our local ecosystem as well as for migrating waterfowl." At Bowles Farming Company, sustainability is part of everything we do. As a farming family with over 150 years of history, sustainability is not just a catchphrase, it's a way of life. To learn how this descendant ranch of the Henry Miller's Million Acre Spread preserves and promotes sustainability today, we sit down around a desk at Bowles Farming Company headquarters on the farm near Los Banos to visit with Executive Vice President Derek Azevedo and Senior Farm Analyst Curtis Gardner. Derek is the Executive Vice President of Bowles Farming Company, and Curtis Gardner. And Curtis, tell me what you do with Bowles Farming Company.
I'm a business analyst.
See, the reason I asked you is I don't know what that means. So I actually did recall saying to business analyst. What does a business analyst do?
So I marry financial data and operational data because they exist in two different silos, two different places, and try to make improvements.
So, Derek, if you're the executive vice president, if he does his job, do you have much work to do? Or
absolutely, Roger. I think you've been around farming enough to know there's always something to do.
Well, you know, I started this thing out saying that while there's a lot of people that I talk to that want to talk about farming small and farming new, and your operation has farmed big and it's old. Could you explain the history of this farm when it got started? Because it was happening even before California was a state, I believe.
Yeah, it was right around the same time. And so the history of Bowles Farming Company begins in about 1858, and that date signifies the partnership between Henry Miller and Charles Lux, two German immigrants that were butchers in San Francisco. And they were a little disappointed with the indigenous breeds of cattle that were here in California at the time. And so they partnered up.
Which were what, like Longhorns or something?
Yeah, they were
like that,
you know, the Spanish-based cattle that came over with Cortez probably when he landed in Mexico.
Okay.
And so they were able to team up, and they went out to Texas, and they bought, I think it was 2,000 head of of more what they call continental breeds, or like a Shorthorn, something like that, a stockier, stouter, more muscular breed of cattle, and they drove them across the Sierras.
This has been a movie.
No, I don't believe it.
No, it must be. No, I mean, this is like a cowboy show. I mean,
yeah,
this is one of those stories where people
City
need
Slickers
to get
3.
Better beef. Yeah, and they drive them.
Yeah, they drove them. Yeah, because in those days, there was no railroad that connected California and the rest of the country, and it was kind of a little bit landlocked in a sense. And so they drove that herd of cattle across. They got them up to San Francisco, finished them, and their butcher trade really took off at that point. And so during that same time, though, there was they witnessed the opportunity to expand that vertical integration. So they started putting together land, and at that time, their strategy was really climate inspired, because they went through a very similar time than we just had, where it was really wet and then or really dry and then followed by really wet. And so they amassed a lot of land in some of the hill ground, so they had feed during the winter time or in really wet periods of time, and then they put together a lot of bottom ground that they could feed their cattle in the summer. And at the height of their land holdings, they had somewhere between 1.2 and 1.4 million acres of land in California, Nevada, and Oregon.
A million acres. Now that's a lot to keep track of.
Yeah.
Now, were the headquarters always around Los Banos?
Pretty much. I mean, they had, you know, the main headquarters at the slaughterhouse there in South San Francisco. Henry Miller's personal residence on Mount Madonna was just to the west of current day Gilroy. But the headquarters here in Los Banos was just that major hub. It was set right in the middle of the Santa Rita land grant.
So if people want to envision this, and there are people listening to Farm to Table Talk, really good listeners around the world, so if they could picture the United States and know about where San Francisco is, Los Banos would be like an hour kind of southeast of San Francisco, hour and a half maybe?
You're looking at roughly 90 miles or so in the south, directly south of San Francisco is the Silicon Valley that you hear of,
sure.
And that stretches down into the Salinas Valley. And then Los Banos is just to the east of the small coastal mountain range in the great San Joaquin Valley.
So, Curtis, did you ever wonder if they needed a business analyst back in the 1875 or so when this was really up and running?
You know, I actually have no idea how Henry Miller did what he did.
Horseback.
I couldn't fathom.
It's all horseback.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I've heard that at Berkeley they have a bunch of letters of how he did it, and he was really involved in the operations, and so much so that he would write letters to the cooks telling them that they used too much salt.
Well, that still exists.
Yeah, they don't have a movie about it, Roger, but there are several books written about him. The most factual is a really neat book about the life of Henry Miller and just in general the history of California, and it's called Industrial Cowboys.
Now, that triggers a thought, because a lot of people, when they hear us talking about large scale anyway, they immediately think of industrialization as necessarily a bad thing. Now, I don't know how you two deal with that, but I'm sure you run into people that think you're so large scale, and so it's industrialized agriculture, so they should be leery of what you do and how you do it. You hear that?
A little bit. You know, I think, you know, when people talk about food, a lot of people throw in, you know, family farm, which we are, or smaller farm, and they think, you know, those customers or those consumers are really craving authenticity, and they want that feeling that who's growing their food really cares about them. You know, and so there's a lot of things that get thrown at us. It's like, oh, well, you're big, you can afford it, and oh, well, you're big, you must not care, and that couldn't be further from the truth. You know, there's a lot of things that we do here on the ranch that, you know, a lot of smaller producers probably couldn't afford. You know, a lot of people don't know that we have a defined benefit program for all of our employees, not just the salaried ones. A lot of people don't know that.
Benefit, so they can come to work for you and get insurance and vacations.
Well, yeah, the way it was structured was that upon retirement they received a benefit, you know, into retirement. You know, we also supply school supplies for our employees' children and grandchildren at the beginning of school, where they get backpacks and binders and books and rulers and all kinds of really cool, you know, canteens, all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah.
No matter how many children you have, if they meet the minimum GPA requirements upon graduating high school, they can qualify for several different scholarships, up to $3,000 per year.
From the farm?
Up to 5 years for the farm. And if you have 10 children and they all go to a, you know, to a University of California, they could earn up to $3,000 per year on a scholarship. And because we believe it's important to take care of our employees, and we're really proud of the fact that our employees have, you know, we have you know, employees and their children working for us, and we want, you know, the core philosophy of our farm is respect and grow. You know, those are the two words when we sit down at our strategic meetings in the off season. We talk about who are we, and if we carry ourselves with respect, we respect each other, we respect the soil, we respect our environment, we respect our crops and our crop partners, and we look to grow both personally and professionally. If we can achieve those two goals, we're going to be a successful outfit.
Well, you know, when I was mentioning earlier about there being a movie, I didn't mean about you necessarily, but I was talking about like Lonesome Dove. I mean, you know, there are so many movies that it's the idea about saying there's people in the East or people in San Francisco that need better cattle, so we're going to have this cattle drive.
And oh, got it.
You know, 2 hours of adventure and rattlesnakes and ambushes and everything else. And so, but you did have that cowboy start. I mean, so when you back with this farm was running 1 million acres, it had cowboys probably carrying guns and dealing with whatever they had to deal with all over this large territory, I would guess. So it's I guess the thing I wanted to jump to on that is that the kind of employees you've had must change a lot over those years because of what either the technology, what the kind of crops, and you switch from cattle to other crops and cotton, and then you start getting technology in. So that almost should be a movie in itself. You could start with people that needed to be good cowboys and riding the range. And just in your experience of what you can see back, how has it changed the kind of workforce that you need, what you need from your employees over the last 100 years?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can't, as a company, you can't survive 160 years without several reinventions of yourself. And as the nature of the crops and the commodities and various things that you grow, I mean, it does put, you know, it does throw wrinkles into the nature of your workforce. You know, the ranch was primarily occupied by Spanish vaqueros back in the first days, and then as they transitioned into more of a row crop farm or an irrigated farm in the, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, there was more Portuguese and Italian immigrants that were working for the farm. And when the farm really reduced in size, you know, a lot of those individuals had the opportunity to purchase land, and those are some of our most valued neighbors today that started, you know, working for Miller and Lux, and then now they own their own ranches and they've got their own families, and that's really cool too. And so, you know, you fast forward to today where we had, you know, and 20 years ago we had just a handful of crops, you know, scaling up was a really important thing. But today we have 24 crops, and so we've got to focus on scaling down. And we've got to break down into smaller, more granular acreages of various crops and just specialize in those small crops. And then if you look at what we're asking from our employees, and Curtis could probably get into this a little bit more, is, you know, when this wave of technology is coming towards us, we've got to ask different things of our people now. It's not quite as much, you know, handling the shovel and heavy lifting with the siphon pipes and the horse-drawn scrapers. It's more managing drip systems and managing, you know, self-guided tractors and a bunch of these types of things, importing information into, you know, their smartphone as to what the daily activities are.
Yeah.
And really, you know, I see a lot of people from a workforce standpoint see issues with millennials, but I think there's a wonderful opportunity with millennials because of the simple fact that people call millennials tech savvy. You'll hear that word
right,
a lot.
Sure.
You know, but I think if you pivot and frame your mind around the fact that millennials are tech dependent, I believe you can craft any business to provide the tech solutions that allow millennials to really flourish and really strive in a business environment. And so I don't know, Curtis, you probably have some expansion on that.
Yeah, what I see kind of in my limited experience here is there's a cultural shift in agriculture kind of happening right now. Kind of longer are the days when it was 3 months of vacation in the wintertime, and then you could kind of control the crops with a limited number of people. The complexity of business has increased to such a degree that we need more information systems. We need people that understand information systems that can pull data from different places and marry them together and kind of make sense of it. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we could never fathom that we would have a drone pilot on staff and we'd be using aerial imagery to look at yields and look at water stress and other factors. As the complexity and competition has increased, we've had to innovate ourselves and really find new ways to compete on a world stage. The I-5 transformed produce in California, and the world's only gotten smaller with technology and freight and cold chain and logistics. And you know, it really is a world platform. And where would you like your food to kind of come from? Would you like it to come from California or another United States farm that's heavily regulated, that's known to be safe, that has laws and penalties to treat workers fairly and pay a living wage? Or would you like it to come from another country that might not have these same protections for the environment, the workers, and food safety?
You were talking technology too, and you've got the drones. Do you use satellite? Where do satellites play a role in the farming operation?
Well, that's kind of the things that drones has been a real sexy thing kind of in agriculture, and a lot of buzz and hype kind of around that. And Cannon is a very tech-centric, forward-thinking individual. We've been around for 160 years, and he's tasked us, how are we going to be around for another 160 years? So he's invested heavily into technology, and drones are only starting to find their place on the farm in where there's kind of direct ROI. In satellite imagery is kind of where the technology and ROI is. It's cheap enough for the farm, for any farm to really afford it, and it provides enough information. And what people really need to think about is the granularity of pixels necessary is the same granularity of your actuation. And so,
wait a minute, say that again in English.
And so let me put it to this way in an example. And so if Sentinel 2 or Landsat 8 can give me 3-meter imagery or 8-meter imagery, you know, roughly say 15 feet imagery, like pixel size, right? So 15 by 15 foot square versus a drone that can give me sub centimeter squares of pixels.
Okay.
But my spray boom that I use to apply is 90 feet long. I can only actuate on a 90 foot by 90 foot square. And so that's the level of granularity I need to make the analysis to do the work.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let me just kind of wrap up on some more, one more thing on this. Well, first of all, you mentioned Cannon, and then their family is still involved that's related to Miller, right?
That's right. So the current CEO of Bowles Farming Company's name is Cannon Michael, and he's an incredibly dynamic leader and is the sixth generation behind. So Henry Miller would have been his third great-grandfather.
Okay, great. So you do really have this incredible continuity too. And then the other thing I just want to wrap up, you mentioned several things that you're doing for sustainability, but let's go back and hit them again. So starting with water and energy, and what are the things that you're most proud of that you're doing that have made you more sustainable than in the past?
So I think primarily our investment into drip irrigation has allowed us to save roughly 20-30% of the water applied to the processing tomatoes, and processing tomatoes is a very large crop for us. And then we used to be a gravity-fed system, and gravity is free. And so these pressurized systems required energy, and that would come in the form of diesel or electricity. And we chose to switch over to electricity and then power those electric pumps with solar power. So when we originally planned our solar designs, we designed them to offset 90% of our energy use needed to power these drip systems.
So you're getting the maximum from it. Anything else, Derek, that you're particularly proud of from the sustainability standpoint and the operation?
Certainly, and it's maybe a little bit of a curveball, but you know, one of the things we reached out to the consumers of our products on social media, on both Instagram, Facebook, is we said, what do you want your ideal farm to look like? What does your ideal farm look like? And these people came back and says, I want somebody that has an environmental focus, that cares about the environment. And I'm incredibly proud that we have an environmental program director, a young gentleman with a master's degree in biology, on staff. And he's helping us manage the wildlife, manage the native species, manage the plants, and on the farm. And it's been incredible to have that fun conversations we have about, you know, how do we grow this native plant better versus how do we use those skills and grow, you know, some farm crops better, and just, you know, having someone like that in our office to play ideas off of has been incredible. I mean, we're in, you know, when we talk about sustainability, we're not just checking boxes on a questionnaire. We're investing in that literally and figuratively, and we've got some really dynamic people that are leading those charges.
And one of the things that I'm kind of most proud about is over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of buzz and a lot of attention paid from the farm to fork movement. And I'm really proud that we've invested and started a composting operation. And we're doing that full cycle, closed loop, cradle to grave. And so now we have farm to fork, fork back to farm. And we have that full cycle. And that's really helping us to invest and keep our soils healthy.
So what does that mean? What is the material that comes back?
That material is primarily generated in the urban environments. And so when California passed 1826 that regulated the compostable items out of landfills, those items have to go somewhere else. And so the items we're receiving is primarily green waste from whether it be lawns or maintenance companies to, we don't receive food waste at this time, but, you know, it's primarily the, you know, tree trimmings and mm-hmm. lawn clippings and all that stuff. If they're coming back to our compost yard, we're able to make compost out of that and apply it back to our ground. And so it's, but it makes, when you think about using an avocado shell or a watermelon rind as a salad bowl or a serving, you know, and that's really cool and that reduces waste, right? But it still has to go somewhere. You know, and so just really encouraging people to think about, you know, when this compostable item needs to go back to a farm, really being careful about not making sure the fork goes with it. You know, this other stuff that we don't want to be spreading on our ranch.
Well, I tell you what, you guys do a good job of explaining this history and the exciting things that you're doing. And then the actual final question I've got for you. So you've made so many changes over the last 160 years. What reasons do you find to be optimistic about the next 5 or 10 years?
That's certainly something that we see a lot of opportunity in, and a lot of it comes potentially from the tech side and just making visible what can't be seen on the farm. You know, how do we use technology to help us understand not only just the moisture level in a field or the growth volume in a field, but how those mycorrhiza communities are interacting with one another, or how the overall biology of the soil could benefit from, you know, different crop rotations and things like that, and just really, really enhance our understanding. You know, farming is all about managing little curves, the seasonal curves, the daily curves, and utilizing that to benefit our crops the most. That technology coming down the pipeline is going to give us the opportunity to level out some of those curves and provide our plants with what they need more efficiently.
Well, gentlemen, it's a great story, and I appreciate talking to Derek Acevedo and Curtis Garner with Bowles Farms, and a story that goes back 160 years. We'll check back in with you in another 160
years.
That was
the year they patented the pencil. So it's been a long time, but I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to share our story a little bit, Roger. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Thanks.
No, I know.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.